Hey, a quick note before we start this episode. This is the second part of a two-part special, so we encourage you to go back and listen to part one of the strange death of José de Jesús, because we'll be referring to it in this episode. And a quick warning, especially for those with little ones, there's some graphic language in the story about suicide that may be difficult for some listeners and may not be appropriate for young children.
From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. This is part two of our two-part series, The Strange Death of José de Jesús. In this series, we've been telling the story of José de Jesús Denis Sahagún. He was found dead at the Eloy Immigration Detention Facility in Arizona in 2015, with a sock stuffed down his throat. Producers Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Chavarri, and myself first reported our investigation about his death in 2016 as a way to tell a larger story about the conditions inside these immigration detention facilities. It's been 4 years since then, but José's story is more relevant than ever. Around 40 immigrants have died in detention since President Trump took office, bringing the total to over 200 since 2004. When we left off last week, we had just received a package in the mail containing surveillance footage from the Eloy detention facility from the exact day that José de Jesús died. We had requested it from the local police department. We hoped it would provide us with some clues as to exactly what happened to José de Jesús.
The first video has 4 hours of surveillance footage from May 20th, 2015, the day José died. The video is grainy and it has no sound.
And this is on the day of his death on May 20th, 2015.
Yeah.
So let's start.
The surveillance camera is looking down at what seems to be one of the medical units at the Eloy Detention Center. In the video, we see detainees walking around. Some are on crutches, two others are being pushed around in wheelchairs. This is clearly a low-level holding area.
So remember, this is the point at which José is still locked up by himself, but he's no longer on suicide watch. He's been downgraded, and we don't really know why. And now he's being checked on every 15 minutes by a guard.
Pause it.
That's José.
Is that the shower area, maybe?
Yeah.
In the video, at about 2:30 p.m., we finally see José. We see two guards walk up to his cell and escort him out. They walk him to the back of the frame, and he walks into an area that the camera can't see. But we know from police documents that this is when José took a shower. Minutes later, he's escorted back to his cell.
This is the last time José is seen walking around, and it's the last time he leaves the cell where he dies.
About 3 hours go by in the surveillance footage, and every 15 minutes, a guard is seen walking by José's door, looking in, and writing something down on a clipboard that's hanging outside his door.
These are the checks that the doctor ordered. And yes, the guard does come by every 15 minutes, although he doesn't spend much more than a few seconds looking in when he walks by.
Then at the 5:30 p.m. check, the guard doesn't just walk by. This time, he looks in and then pauses.
Looks in.
At 5:27, stares.
Maybe not.
Knocks on the door to José's cell.
The guard is bending over, looking inside through a cutout in the door that they use to give detainees their food. And he continues to bend down for a couple of minutes, perhaps calling out his name.
And now he's standing there, looks unsure, looks in again.
Doesn't look like he's called for help. Now he's moving quickly. It's a sign that he realizes something must be wrong.
Now they've got a detainee looking in the door, probably speaking Spanish. No response. He comes back with a few more guards. They open the door for a second and then quickly shut it again. One by one, five guards and two nurses gather outside the door, waiting for another guard to come with a protective shield. 7 minutes have gone by since the guard found him unresponsive. Finally, they open the door and move in. This is where the second video comes in. It's a handheld video taken by a guard in that very moment, the moment the guards and medical staff enter José's cell.
Oh my God.
It's going to be hard to watch
this. Oh my God. All right, so the first thing we see is actually just a stop frame of some feet, like looking like they're
running.
Look at how long the video is. How long is it?
2:53.
Oh my God.
This is going to be intense, mm-hmm. people.
The video starts with Jose lying face down on a green mattress. He's not moving. And the first guard that goes in puts a riot shield on his back. Jose is still alive, but unresponsive.
He's having a seizure. Go
over there.
Now, Jose is clearly making choking sounds, and his body is entirely limp. Somebody misdiagnoses and says he's having a seizure. Somebody else says, if he's seizing, just leave him there.
He's having a seizure.
Another guard grabs Jose's arms, pulls them behind his back, and puts handcuffs on them. That's when the shield is removed.
The medical staff takes his pulse. Meanwhile, someone gives an order to take the handcuffs off.
Take the cuffs off.
Take the cuffs off.
One of the guards seems to be having a hard time finding the right key and then fitting the key in the handcuffs. He's struggling to get them off of Jose.
Because it's taking him so long, another guard tries to help him get the handcuffs off. Almost 1 minute goes by before the handcuffs are removed.
Hurry up, Ranger.
To give you an idea of how much time a minute is, that was just 12 seconds of it.
Right after the handcuffs are removed, the video stops. We've been reporting on this case for so long. We've met Jose's family, and we felt like we knew a lot about him. And yet, this is the first time that we have ever seen him.
The footage is haunting. And yes, it leaves us with some answers, but with even more questions.
It's possible that they're doing everything by the book, but there's no way around it is that looking at it, you know, looking at them like spend 45 seconds, fiddle with keys, unhandcuffing them while a man is dying is super hard to watch, you know?
We know what happens. We know he dies. So we just watched the last 2 minutes and 53 seconds of somebody being alive. It's a lot. And knowing what we know now, the people in that room didn't know, but we know that what we're watching is somebody who put a sock down his mouth so far down his throat we can't even see it.
Then the question now for me is, what would have driven him to do this? What would have made him feel so helpless?
And now we also have to figure out what to do with what we know.
We've watched something that his family hasn't. We know something that other people don't, that only a handful of people who were in the room, they're really the only people who have seen this, who know what it looked like exactly at that moment. So there's this weird feeling of knowing that we got to see that.
I mean, I feel like we should show it to a doctor or something.
I'm very worried about the family because the way Jose de Jesus dies is pretty terrible. So I'm thinking a lot about, you know, our responsibility to share this with them and all the details that we found and just how horrible that's going to be. Jose's parents, Silverio and Elisa, and his brother Gabriel, had told us that no matter how difficult it was, whatever we uncovered, they wanted to know. And so, we picked up the phone and called Gabriel in Las Vegas.
We tell him that we have some sensitive information about his brother's death, and we ask him if he would like to see it.
He says yes, and so we're off to Las Vegas once again. No te vayas.
The
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Latino to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Welcome back to this special edition of Latino USA, The Strange Death of José de Jesús. I'm Maria Hinojosa with producers Fernanda Chavarri and Marlon Bishop.
When we left off, we had just called José de Jesús' brother, Gabriel, and told him about the videos we have that would give him more information about the last moments of José's life.
Gabriel said that no matter how painful it might be, he wanted to see the videos. So we went to his home in Las Vegas to show him.
Okay, so we just landed in Las Vegas and we took a cab.
Yeah, the first time that we came here was almost a year ago. On both occasions, we visited this family here in Las Vegas in a very sad situation.
When we get to Gabriel's house, we see his sister Rosario and their parents, Silverio and Elisa, who are visiting from Mexico.
Gabriel says the four of them talked it over and decided that they would all sit together and watch these videos as a family.
We start with the first video, the 4 hours of surveillance footage. That's when the family sees that José was alone with the door locked and that nobody went in for those hours before his death, putting to rest any doubt about whether or not somebody had hurt José.
Still, seeing all of this for the first time is upsetting for them.
Alterado mentalmente, como dicen, ¿para qué lo encerraban así? Él lo que necesitaba era comunicación con alguien más.
No sentirse. If he was already not well, then why did they lock him up alone? Rosario asks.
Mm-hmm. This is where they go to take him out for a shower. And
when we get to the part of the surveillance video that shows José being escorted out of his cell and taken to the showers, his family goes quiet. This is the only time José can be seen alive and walking around in the video. So they ask us to rewind that grainy tape and play that footage again.
We fast forward and get to the part in the video 3 hours later when the guard first notices that José is not moving.
Gabriel watches the timestamp on that surveillance footage and he gets visibly more and more upset as the minutes go by and nobody enters his brother's cell.
How come the security guard... He's been like 2 minutes and he's still talking to a body, let's say, like that, because and he's not doing nothing about it.
He asks us again to tell him what time it was when the guards noticed José was unresponsive. And that's when he realizes that it's almost exactly the same time that he had tried to call and check up on his brother.
And they tell me that it wasn't going to be possible for them to communicate with my brother. I was okay, I'll call him back tomorrow. And then I went to the restaurant, we ordered, we eat, and after that I took some pictures and I can see the date and the time of picture.
So you were calling to speak to your brother at about 5 o'clock?
Yes. Between 5 and 6, I'm pretty sure.
On the day that he died?
Yes.
And all they said to you was he was unavailable?
Yes. That's what they told me. It wasn't going to be possible. And I was, okay, I'll call back tomorrow. But I never thought about this was going on.
We finish with the surveillance footage and ask the family once again if they're sure that they want to watch the video from inside José's cell.
¿Están necesitan un minuto?
No, o sea, lo vemos, no. Por más difícil que sea, tenemos que aceptar que lo que le hayan hecho a mí.
José's father says that no matter how tough it is, they have to watch so they can see what happened. And so we press play.
Estaba vivo.
Ahí está vivo.
Sí.
Up until this point, the family didn't know much about what happened to Jose other than what was in the autopsy report. They had no idea that Jose was alive when the guards entered his cell. Rosario tries to look away when she sees her brother choking and being handcuffed.
¿Por qué no lo ayudaron?
¿No lo ayudaron? No hicieron nada por él. ¿Está checando la presión?
Ay, qué tonto.
At one point, Gabriel asked his family if they wanted to keep watching, and they all said yes. As they watched, they kept asking, why isn't anyone helping him?
If the video is showing that, if he did commit suicide, what lends my brother to do that?
For Gabriel, that question, why, is bigger than just Jose.
And this can happen to another family today, tomorrow. We don't know. They don't think like if they're helping a family member or, you know, it's a person, no matter what, it's a person.
We say goodbye to the family in Las Vegas and head back to New York.
There, we reach out to a medical professional who might be able to answer Gabrielle's questions about the quality of Jose's medical care at Eloy.
My name is Dr. Alan Keller.
Dr. Keller directs a program at New York University on the intersection of healthcare and human rights.
In the late 90s, he led a groundbreaking study of healthcare in detention.
One of the things we found is that immigration detention is harmful to the health and well-being of those detained, particularly psychologically and emotionally. They are held in prison-like conditions, monitored by guards who come from a correctional mindset.
Keller found in his study that in the places where immigrants were detained, medical services were really set up for people who were going to be there for a very short period of time.
There was virtually no mental health services.
His study also found that many detainees often would not report that they were depressed or suicidal.
Because they knew it was a one-way ticket to segregation, what in many places is referred to as the hole.
Dr. Keller says that since then, ICE has created detention standards that have led to improvements, but not nearly enough.
So I watched the video several times. The first time
we asked Dr. Keller to watch the video of Jose's death with us and tell us what he saw from a medical perspective.
Let me go ahead and press play.
Okay, so the first thing they do is handcuff him. What I notice is missing is that they're not looking in his mouth.
Is that standard?
Look, in cardiopulmonary resuscitation and in, you know, basic life support, when you're taught the ABCs, A stands for airway, B stands for breathing, C stands for circulation. So the first thing you do or are supposed to do is to check if they have a patent airway.
And that means, is the airway open? Can the person breathe?
And the way you do that is you look in someone's mouth. I see he's feeling for a pulse, assessing circulation.
That's the hand on the neck?
Right, yeah, so that's the C, but they skipped the A and the B.
Which means they didn't check his airway or his breathing.
The first thing going through their head was not A for airway, it was S for safety, and that's in many ways understandable. But again, between the handcuffing and then uncuffing him, that's precious time. The clock of life is ticking.
And Dr. Keller says if the staff really did think that Jose was having a seizure, that would explain why they might not have wanted to open his mouth. But from what he can see in the video, it didn't look like a seizure.
It does raise a question to me about what training in advanced life support the individuals who showed up had. But, you know, as I mentioned, the ABCs are something that, you know, every lifeguard is taught.
There are over 1,500 people held at Eloy.
Yet, there is no medical doctor or psychologist on site 24/7. According to the police report, the medical staff that responded in this case was two nurses and a physician's assistant.
Dr. Keller says even though isolation can make symptoms worse, it's the right thing to do when somebody is in immediate danger.
After looking at the available facts of Jose's case, Dr. Keller's overall feeling is that Jose's death could have been prevented. And for him, this case goes beyond emergency care.
Who was this man? This was a man who may have had a very serious illness, depression, but he was also a man who had a family that he missed terribly. He was also a man that had lived in this country for some time and had not been here legally, and that's a problem. But he had not been a danger to our country. Why was this individual in immigration detention in the first place? And did he need to be? And a haunting question that I think we all need to live with.
The question raised by Dr. Keller, in a lot of ways, is central to the investigation of Jose's death. Whether a man in extreme psychological distress who turned himself over to Border Patrol seeking protection, should that man have been taken to a detention center in the first place?
Not long after we spoke with Dr. Keller, something happened that gave us some more perspective on that question. Something big.
It was a document that ICE just posted on their website with reports of different deaths that have happened in immigration custody, including the one of Jose de Jesus.
We weren't expecting it, but shortly before we went to air with our series, ICE released an internal investigation into Jose's death by its own Office of Detention Oversight. Investigators went to Eloy about a month after Jose died, but the report wasn't made public until over a year later.
From the moment Jose de Jesus died, this is the document we've been waiting for.
Yeah, it's a lot.
The report fills in many of the missing pieces of the puzzle, starting with what happened at the border checkpoint. Border Patrol agents who were interviewed for this report said Jose was hysterical when he ran up to them.
Twice jumping from a concrete bench in a Border Patrol hold room and landing on his head.
Jose told agents that he was trying to break his own neck so he could die before somebody else could kill him. Remember in the autopsy, the medical examiner found mysterious head injuries? This could explain those.
Border Patrol took Jose to Banner University Medical Center in Tucson, a hospital a few hours north. And according to the report, Jose was treated for his head injuries and given a neck brace. But hospital staff said he couldn't be seen by a psychiatrist because he was in the custody of the Border Patrol.
We reached out to hospital reps, and they said that every patient at Banner receives emergency medical care regardless of citizenship. But they said because of privacy laws, they couldn't comment on this case.
So Jose left the hospital without seeing a psychologist just one day after his suicide attempt and was taken to the Eloy Detention Center.
There were no medical or mental health records from the hospital for Jose when he arrived there, even though he showed up wearing the neck brace.
The Border Patrol agents who dropped Jose off at Eloy told the staff there that he had been suicidal, but the Eloy staff didn't flag Jose for special treatment.
So at this point, there were three instances where people knew Jose had tried to kill himself. Yet when he enters Eloy, he's put with the general population on the first day.
Here's text from the internal investigation.
He said that it was the first time that he felt desperate enough to kill himself and that he felt safer since arriving at the Eloy Detention Center and he no longer wanted to kill himself.
Routine rather than urgent is how the health referral was classified.
That's a little surprising to me.
Yeah.
The report also helps explain something that other detainees had told us, that they had heard Jose screaming for help. The report says there were multiple use of force incidents by guards during the course of Jose's second day at Eloy when he tried to run away from them.
They decide they need to take Denise Agun to the ground in order to gain control over him. They describe Denise Agun as completely uncompliant, uncooperative, and aggressive during this incident.
The report says at times Jose was screaming, "Help me! Call my lawyer!" And this is brutality.
Jose was later seen by a psychologist inside the detention center who diagnosed him with a brief reactive psychosis, something the psychologist said could happen in response to trauma or major stress and could cause hallucinations, delusions, and confusion.
The doctor ordered a nurse to give Jose two antipsychotic medications, even if they needed to be given to him involuntarily.
But the nurse didn't think Jose needed them because he had calmed down. And in the end, she never gave them to him.
The next day, on the day Jose died, the psychologist checked up on him, unaware that the nurse hadn't given Jose the meds he was prescribed. And Jose's behavior appeared to have completely changed by then.
This is a statement that is used to take him off suicide watch and put him on 15-minute watch.
31-year-old English-speaking male from Mexico presents today with a clear sensorium, embarrassed about the events of yesterday, states that his mind suddenly started making connections between voices, people, sounds, and perceptions that convinced him that he was going to die here.
He has no explanation for why he started thinking that way.
He's completely agreeable to ongoing mental health services as indicated and requests classes or groups on personal growth.
This is the point when Jose's level of supervision was downgraded. 9 hours later, Jose ended his life.
Getting the documents from this internal investigation finally helped explain so many things that we had been wondering about over the year we'd been investigating this case. For example, why the guards waited for the shield before they entered Jose's cell, what the delusional behavior was that led the detention center to put him on suicide watch, and why he was heard screaming for help.
The report also highlights a number of deficiencies, in the investigator's own words, in how the detention center handled the incident. Here are the big ones.
For one, they found that the doctor didn't follow procedure when taking Jose off of suicide watch because he didn't fill out a thorough mental health evaluation or to check to see if the nurse ever gave him the antipsychotic drugs that he was prescribed.
Also, the guards may have needed backup when entering Jose's cell, but the report determined that waiting 7 minutes for the protective shield before helping him was too long, especially because at one point there were more than four guards waiting at the door.
And another thing from the report, the investigators found that Eloy had no mental health providers on call after hours, a major breach of ICE healthcare standards.
So after reading all of these recommendations, we wanted to hear directly from ICE. It took a month of back and forth before we were finally granted an interview. We spoke with Liz Cedillo Pereira. She's the senior advisor to the agency's director.
In one of these reports made public regarding the suicide of Jose de Jesus Denis Sahagún, there was criticism raised as to how the medical staff acted and pointed out several failings on the part of CCA. What is your response to those criticisms?
While not going into any specific scenarios, we are constantly reviewing our practices as well as the vendors that we use, the practices that they use. We're all adhering to a set of standards. And if those standards are not being met, then we would take quick action to adhere to those standards.
But according to the ACLU, the standards that the Epideta is talking about are not legally binding under U.S. law and therefore difficult to enforce.
We also requested an interview with the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, the private prison company that runs Eloy. CCA declined the interview request, but said that they would respond to some questions in writing. So we sent those questions, but got no response.
The conclusion of the ICE internal investigation points out the lack of a proper suicide prevention plan at Eloy, despite the fact that Jose's suicide was the third since 2013 and the fifth since 2005, making it by far the facility with the most immigrant suicides in the country.
The report ends with a note that Eloy should develop such a plan.
We wanted to know, though, will this report, however harsh, lead to any changes? Will there be any consequences for CCA or for Eloy? In a follow-up email after our interview, we asked ICE whether the report has any teeth to affect changes. ICE didn't give a specific answer to that question, but sent a written statement saying that the release of these reports, quote, reflects ICE's continuing resolve to improve conditions of confinement.
Coming up on Latino USA, the collateral damage of immigration detention.
I don't know, I just think we need to make a difference before other people start killing themselves or other people get killed.
That's coming up next on Latino USA.
I'm Guy Raz, and on NPR's How I Built This, how a simple splash of color accidentally launched Sandy Chilowich into a 40-year career as a designer, entrepreneur, and creator of the now famous Chilowich placemat. Subscribe or listen now.
Welcome back to Latino USA and part two of The Strange Death of José de Jesús. I'm María Hinojosa with producers Fernanda Chavarri and Marlon Bishop. One evening while we were in Phoenix during our reporting on José de Jesús' death, we visited a detention support group meeting.
The meeting was at Puente. Puente is the immigrant activist group that first tipped us off to Jose's story. And many of the people here at this meeting have family members in detention or have been in detention themselves. They gather here every week to support each other, to organize campaigns, and to figure out how to get their loved ones back home.
We came here because we wanted to get a wider view of what it's like to go through immigration detention. And the same complaint kept coming up with all of the people that we spoke with.
Las celdas las tienen bien frías, bien frías.
Jose Mejia says they kept the cells freezing cold at Eloy. Others talked about being disrespected by guards or about the bad food. But the most persistent complaint was about medical care.
Okay, yo metí un request. Fíjate, tienes que meter un request para que te manden al doctor.
He says that to see a doctor inside Eloy, you have to put in a request first. He maintains it could take days for the request to arrive, and then a few more days before you would actually get to see a doctor.
He says more often than not, after all that, medical staff would just tell patients to drink water and send them on their way. That's something that immigrant rights activists in other parts of the country have also complained about for years.
Toma agua, tú necesitas agua nomás. Eso es lo que siempre te decían.
And detention isn't just hard on the people being detained. Its effects ripple out to a whole web of other people. Take Jose Mejia's daughter, Alejandra, for example.
It really hurts when you see your own father go through that.
Her dad was inside Eloy for 9 or 10 months. Alejandra was in high school at the time.
It was also during, like, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and my birthday. Like, all those events, I had to, like, go through them without him. So it was like really nothing to celebrate. We wouldn't celebrate because it just wasn't the same.
For Alejandra, like for many of the immigrants here at the Puente meeting, the death of José de Jesús hit close to home.
I saw the picture of him on the internet. Like, I was curious. I wanted to know how he looked like. And he must have been really depressed to do that. I like give thanks to God that my dad didn't have to go through that.
And even though her own father is out, she thinks about those still inside.
I don't know, I just think we need to make a difference before other people start killing themselves or other people get killed.
Earlier in the show, Dr. Alan Keller posed a question. Was José de Jesús a man that needed to be detained?
And that's the big question. It's a medical question, it's a political question, and it's an ethical question.
And it goes beyond José's case. If the country is detaining people at taxpayer expense just to eventually deport them or to let them go while they're waiting to get their legal status resolved, well, what's the point?
Someone who thinks a lot about the ethics of detention is Grace Meng. She's a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, and her organization recently put out a report about lapses in medical care that led to deaths in immigration detention centers. That report included the death of José de Jesús.
Detention of a migrant should be a matter of last resort. It should be an exception, not the rule.
She challenges the notion that someone like José should have been put in detention at all.
The thought that someone who is expressing fear of being killed in his home country, that we would put that person in a jail-like setting is the first sort of assumption that I would really question. Any psychological or mental health problems would likely be increased in a jail-like setting.
If the people who had who were with Jose de Jesus had actually wanted another alternative as opposed to taking him to Eloy and put him in detention, what would those alternatives, what do they exist? What would they have been?
If you find someone who has some serious medical need, whether it's mental health or physical health, they should be in a hospital. They should not be just left willy-nilly on the street or in a detention center. And I think it's possible to say that in Denise Sahagun's case, he should have been in a hospital and been given close monitoring and treatment.
Instead, he was taken to Eloy.
And I think definitely his case, especially because it happened after other suicides at the same facility, raises serious questions about how seriously this facility is taking suicide prevention.
In addition to the 5 suicides at the Eloy Detention Center since 2005, there were 53 people placed on suicide watch there in 2013 alone, according to the most recent available reports from ICE.
But Liz Cedillo Pereira, the high-ranking ICE official we spoke to, believes suicide is generally not a big problem in the ICE detention system nationwide.
We looked it up, and out of more than 300,000 people who brought into our facilities last year, one individual took their life. And of course, that's unfortunate. We think that one is too many. But this does tell us that our protocols to prevent these types of scenarios are being effective, largely speaking.
But stories like that of Jose put the whole detention immigration system and its purpose under scrutiny. For years, immigrant rights activists have criticized the use of detention as a deterrent, saying that keeping people without criminal records in prison-like facilities and using that to send a message of don't come here illegally is a violation of their human rights.
Illegal migration into this country has dropped considerably since...
In 2014, Jay Johnson, the Secretary of Homeland Security, said, quote, "We want to send a message that our border is not open to illegal migration, and if you come here, you should not expect to simply be released."
But we're certain that it is also due in very large measure to the deterrent factor of our border security efforts.
However, when we asked Liz Cedillo Pereira, the senior ICE official, if detention was used as a deterrent to illegal immigration, she said it wasn't so black and white.
It's not something that we're looking at as a way to provide a punitive measure to individuals who are crossing our borders. But we are charged with the enforcement of immigration laws. Part of that charge is to ensure that individuals are not with the misunderstanding that our borders are open for free crossings.
But Grace Meng of Human Rights Watch questions the strategy of detaining so many people.
Immigration detention is allowed in exceptional circumstances, you know, under international law. But in the U.S., it's just a regular practice. It happens frequently to asylum seekers, to mothers with children, to people who are long-term permanent residents of the U.S. who've lived here for decades. There, for many of them, there's no individualized assessment of whether they're a flight risk, whether they are a threat to public safety. And I don't think that a system that deprives people of their liberty in any sort of automatic way is one that is fair or humane. And so I certainly would support an effort to severely and significantly reduce the immigration detention system in the U.S.
According to a report by the Migration Policy Institute, the U.S. spends more money on immigration enforcement and detention than on all other federal law enforcement agencies combined. That includes the FBI, the DEA, the Secret Service, and so on. So Grace Meng wants to know why.
Is it focused on counterterrorism? Because certainly the vast number of people being stopped, you know, at the border have, no one would say that they are in any way connected to terrorism. Is it because there's some severe damage happening to the U.S.? There's no evidence that immigrants commit crimes at higher rates than native-born. Actually, there's evidence that they commit crime at lower rates than native-born Americans. I think on this issue of immigration enforcement, there's not been a really robust, smart conversation on what are we spending? Do the benefits outweigh the costs? Instead, we've just decided to spend and spend and spend.
Walked 0.5 miles.
Yeah, it's gonna be a while.
That's it?
On the one-year anniversary of José de Jesús's death, immigrant activists marched to the Eloy Detention Center to hold a vigil in his honor.
We're out here today in Eloy, Arizona.
That's Francisca Porchas, the organizing director at Puente, where we attended the detention support group.
And we're walking. There's about 50 of us that are making a four-mile walk to mark the one-year anniversary of José de Jesús Agún Denise's death, and also to mark the 151 lives that have been lost throughout detention centers in the country without anyone really knowing their names, the circumstances, their stories. It's going to be mostly ceremonial. We hope to eat, to break bread together, to play music as a honoring José de Jesús and a lot of the people that have passed away. If the wind is nice to us, we'll have lit candles.
In 100-degree heat, the activists made their way through the tiny desert town of Eloy and stopped right outside the fence surrounding the detention center.
Some of the people in the crowd were former detainees themselves. They gave short speeches, hoping that detainees inside might hear them.
Ellos ahorita están felices, ¿eh? Felices porque nos vieron a todos aquí. Ellos se sienten protegidos.
They're happy to see us here, says a man named Juan Miguel Cornejo. They feel protected the way I felt when I was inside there and saw you all out here supporting us.
Another man read a poem written from the imagined perspective of José de Jesús. What it lacked in biographical accuracy, it made up for in raw emotion.
I loved life, he says. I loved my children. I wanted to return home to Mexico one day, a success story like so many I had heard. And I did return, but I returned feet first.
The organizers had hoped to get some attention with their vigil, but almost no media showed up. Telemundo was there, but left early. Yet Francisca was still hopeful they were making an impact.
We hope that this is a case that we can bring to light, that we can profile it nationally, that everybody will know José de Jesús's name, and that there'll be some serious policy changes and ways in which, you know, our people, our immigrant people, are treated in this country.
And then the activists read out the names of the dead, over 150 of them. The names hung in the scorching air for a second each, and then, one by one, were carried off into the desert by the Arizona wind.
Presente. Simón Guardo Rolando.
Presente.
Negis Julu.
Presente.
Stop. Incha Vera.
Presente.
Cruz Silva Arondo.
Presente.
Martínez Medina Roberto.
Presente.
Jiménez Rojas Sergio.
Presente.
A year before, when we first heard José de Jesús's name, we had no idea where our search for answers would take us. At first, all we knew was that name and that he died in a detention center with an orange sock in his throat.
Over time, we met his family in Las Vegas and then in Mexico, and the details began to fill themselves in. We requested documents and videos, and slowly but surely, the truth of what happened to him came ever more into focus.
As we discovered those truths, we share them with Jose's family. And now, it was time to do that again.
Hello?
Hola, Gabriel. Es María Hinojosa. ¿Cómo estás?
We called up Jose's brother, Gabriel, in Las Vegas. It had been about a month since we last saw him, and he hadn't heard about the new documents that ICE had released. So we filled him in.
Nos enteramos qué fue lo que pasó cuando llegó, cuando estaba en la custodia de la patrulla fronteriza.
We told him about his brother's suicide attempt at the border and the psychosis at the detention center, about running away and being tackled repeatedly by guards, and about not getting the medication he was prescribed. After we tell him this, Gabriel says that, yeah, maybe something happened that made his brother paranoid and suicidal, and that maybe he got worse because he was locked up without communication and didn't have anybody to tell him that everything would be okay.
This situation could have been avoided, Gabriel says, and it can still be avoided for other people.
In the end, he says, it gives the family some peace to know what really happened and to resign themselves to the truth that José was suffering from mental health issues at Eloy
and that he died by suicide.
It's time to move forward in our lives, Gabriel says. There's nothing we can do to bring him back. Could José de Jesús' story have ended another way? There are so many what-ifs.
What if he hadn't gone off his medication? What if he had been allowed to see a psychiatrist in the hospital before he was taken to the detention center? What if he had been able to speak with his family when he was so desperate to call them?
What if the guard had opened the door 7 minutes sooner? What if they had found the sock and had been able to pull it out?
As for José's three young children, they still don't know that their father is dead. Their grandma, Elisa, has been fending off questions from the oldest, who's now 8 years old. He wants to know why the FaceTime calls with Papa in Mexico have suddenly stopped. According to her, the kid's mother has made the choice not to tell them.
José is resting now in Mexico, in a beautiful grave built by his family in a little cemetery near the Pacific Ocean, close to a place he once called home, and so very far, a whole border away from the place he wanted home to be. This episode originally aired in July of 2016 and was produced by Marlon Bishop and Fernanda Chavarri, who nowadays is an immigration reporter for Mother Jones magazine. The Strange Death of José de Jesús received the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. This investigation was reported with assistance from the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering criminal justice. Our deepest thanks to the Denise de Sahagún family, and an update, Silverio Denis, José de Jesús' father, passed away this year. We are sending our deepest condolences to the family. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Sofia Palizacá, Luis Treyes, Janice Yamoca, Julieta Martinelli, Giri Montalvo, Alice Escarce, and Alejandra Salazar, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our engineers are Stephanie Lebeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our director of programming and operations is Natalia Fidelhotz. Our digital editor is Amanda Alcántara. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Julia Rocha. Our interns are Sofia Sanchez and Marie Mendoza. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.